Okay, Chris, I'm going to say a name, and you tell me if you know who this person is.
Okay.
Carol Birdsong.
Carol Birdsong. Don't rightfully know who that is. It sounds like someone that would be a bird watcher of some sort, or maybe a lyricist or a singer.
Okay. All right. You're getting close. She is here local to me and is probably more famous than many country music artists who are also here in this area. She is the director of communications for Williamson County Schools here in Tennessee. She calls when there's a snow day. It's a recording. All the parents get it. She has gotten to be so famous that about 10 years ago, some students made a music video and wrote a song about her.
Carol Birdsong. School will be closed in Williamson County on Tuesday, January 11th.
Welcome to Touchpoint, a podcast dedicated to discussions on digital marketing and patient engagement strategies for hospitals, health systems, and physician practices. In this podcast, we'll dive deep into digital tools, solutions, and strategies that are impacting our industry today. We hope to share a lot of great information with you and have fun along the way. Thanks for joining us. Now, here are your hosts.
Welcome to Touchpoint, episode number 212. Seems like that's a... We'll be back in 2-2. What is that from? Is that the match game or something?
Yeah, the match
anyway,
game.
Anyway, sorry. Last week was 3-11. Now we're talking about the match game. Gone completely off track. I am Reed Smith. That is Chris Boyer. You are listening to Touchpoint. Touchpoint comes out every Wednesday and has for now 212 straight Wednesdays. Mm-hmm. Oh, man, that's a lot. That is a lot of episodes. You may be wondering more about this show. I hope you are. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to learn more, you can go to our website, touchpoint.health. You can learn more about this exact episode that you're listening to, show notes and whatnot, links and all the kind of fun stuff that we mentioned. But you can also find about past episodes. You can dig in. You can search by topic. You can find all kinds of stuff. You're also going to find on that website other shows on the network. So not just more episodes of this show, other shows. So the Exam Room, Data Point, Healthcare Insight for Marketers, Intersection, Gear and Review, the list goes on and on. Be sure to check those out. While you're there, sign up for the TPS report. Weekly email comes out every Monday morning. Five articles from around the industry aggregated by the show host of the network. Get your week off to a good start. A few other links to some things if you find interesting what's going on Twitter or maybe episodes from the previous week, etc. But again, just five episodes. Sign up for that. Let us hear from you on social media. We will pause for just a second and be right back with today's show. Chris, in today's digital age, your online reputation, as we all know, is crucial. With customers relying on online reviews, your first impression is also compared directly with your competitors.
Sure is. And Reed, consider this. 86% of patients today read online reviews, and 73% demand that that healthcare provider has a minimum 4-star rating.
Demand. They demand it.
Yeah, they do.
Well, to stand out, choose reputation to help amplify your brand and to build trust. Be the provider of choice in your area, understand patient sentiment, get actionable insights, and even foster patient loyalty.
And look, here's the easy way you could do that. All you need to do is go visit reputation.com/touchpoint. That's reputation.com/touchpoint, where you can download their healthcare online reputation management guide and build a reputation that performs for you. Today, Reed, we're going to be talking about a topic that we haven't really addressed for quite a few episodes. And I think that's in part because last year, with the shift of everything in the pandemic and the impacts to hospitals and health systems, this hasn't really been top of mind. And that is digital advertising.
Yeah, we still do that.
isn't it fair to say, though, that we're doing things a little bit differently now than we did maybe a year ago?
Yeah, I think certainly just out of necessity, because, like, for example, when electives were paused, well, you don't really want to advertise things that don't exist, right? So you're probably turning off some advertising campaigns. Maybe one thing that never paused was recruitment advertising, potentially. But yeah, I mean, certainly it's changed quite a bit, both from a cadence and maybe even buy as you think about budgets and those types of things going up or down. But certainly how we're targeting and the way that we're messaging, I'm sure, has evolved quite a bit.
The way consumers are using our digital platforms and responding to ads are also changing. I would say we've been on a trajectory where digital advertising in and of itself was starting to be a little bit mistrusted as a way to communicate with our patients or our customers. But it's probably gone a little bit even further over the last year. And of course, certainly with all the digital changes that we've talked about, our consumer is a little bit different.
Well, you found a very robust, to use a word that I hear a lot on Zoom calls, report. It is the 2021 Digital Advertising Trends Report. And we like to go through these types of things. This is by a group called PostClick. It's done back in October, so just a couple of months ago. But really looking at, based on a survey that they conducted, you know, what's trending? What's the plan? What's 2021 look like for everybody? Where are people looking to invest? How have things changed? It's a healthy response. You know, they had almost 1,500 people take the survey, ranging anywhere from, you know, some of the folks probably pushing and pulling a lot of the levers, so specialists, coordinators, managers, those types of folks, all the way up certainly to directors, VPs, folks in the C-suite, et cetera. So nice across roles within the organization, but certainly industries, business types, company sizes, et cetera.
They actually summarized all of their results of the survey into a grouping of 8 findings, and each one of them have some really unique applications for us in healthcare. We certainly encourage people that are listening in and want to learn more, go through in the show notes and download the full report so you can have it and you can kind of refer to all the charts. Let's jump into the first finding, Reed. This one didn't really surprise me. They said, against the backdrop of the pandemic, digital advertising is slated to grow in 2021.
They say that, you know, collectively or kind of on the whole, marketers showed some level of optimism, certainly even amidst the pandemic. 2 in 3, or 68% specifically, said they expect their digital advertising budget to increase in the next year.
So that doesn't surprise me. We are using digital more and more.
Yes.
Clearly, in healthcare, that makes sense. We want to invest more into digital, but that reflects sort of a growing trend towards digital being a bigger part of the marketing mix, so to speak. But when they asked a follow-on question, it says, how do you expect your budget to change per marketing channel? It was very clear that marketers predict that they're going to actually outright cut funding for traditional channels, such as like direct mail, in-person events, that sort of thing, and migrate almost directly those resources towards those digital channels, which include things like paid social, paid search, and here's an interesting one, connected video or online video, you know, all of the different places that we go now to get our entertainment.
Where do we come down on billboards? Do they say anything about billboards? I feel like, you know, we just need like a running tally of how many times we mentioned billboards, how much people spend on it, et cetera. No. Yeah, I don't find that surprising. Certainly, some would say that we have vaulted 5 years ahead.
Some have said that.
Sorry, I'm gonna use that stat like for roughly a year now. We've said that stat from a McKinsey study that was like last April. But in any case, are we talking about the marketing budget or the digital marketing budget, right? And so we're talking about digital advertising. So let's be real clear about this. It's not that necessarily, not that we don't see some overarching, you know, MarCom budgets going up, but really like that's a good stat that we're reallocating money disproportionately to the digital side of the equation because of what we need it to do.
And let's talk about what we need it to do, because they asked a couple of other questions. One was around, how do you expect your cost per click to change? And then how do you expect your cost per conversion to change in this upcoming year? So not surprisingly, they expected Google and Facebook's cost per click to grow. Around half said their advertising costs will increase around cost per click. But then when they asked about cost per conversion, everybody was kind of in the same bucket, so to speak. That kind of alludes to the fact is that we are still, when we come to advertising, we still focus an inordinate amount of our activity towards the click, and we still struggle with that conversion.
I don't know that we know how to answer these questions. Honestly, right? I mean, the first thing that came into mind was in Meet the Parents when he asked him like how his portfolio, and he's like, "Oh, it's good to really good." Like, I mean, like we're stammering around trying to figure out like exactly what that's going to look like. So I think that is going to be very interesting. The second finding that they talk about here is Google and Facebook continue to be at the top of the mountain. Instagram is a growing importance, and then everybody get ready, TikTok making an entrance in 2021.
Oh boy.
Here we go. Is it like cost per dance or lead per floss or something? Anyway, they asked specifically, obviously, which advertising platforms are you currently using? Which advertising platforms do you plan to start using? So 78%, almost 8 in 10 folks responded that they use both Google and Facebook. Not terribly surprising.
No, not terribly surprising at all. In fact, 44% of marketers also identified Google as their top performing platform. They're putting their money where they think the actual performance is coming from. Facebook is second in terms of their highest performing. They said 25% of marketers says it drives the highest ROAS, or return of ad spend. There's a four-letter acronym. Maybe we need to do a podcast around four-letter acronyms in the future.
Return on ad spend. I like
that. Right. But they have other interesting platforms here, too, that I found to be fascinating. Bing made the top 10.
Oh, my word. Seriously?
Yeah, yeah. Amazon actually was more than Bing, though, which is an interesting shift. Quora is on the list, too.
Quora.
And Snapchat's still there, too.
Yeah, this is not your kid's Snapchat anymore.
Nope.
That's not in there. Instagram, though, they do say followed what, was right on the heels of Google and Facebook, which I would imagine that to be true. If you think about just in your sphere of parents and cousins and friends down the street and other parents at your kid's school and this, that, and the other, obviously they're going to, you're going to be able to get to them. You're going to find them on Google.
Yeah.
Still on Facebook, although they may not be actively using it as much, still on Facebook. But, Instagram is that predominant piece, that you're looking at. Okay, that may overtake Facebook from just an engagement standpoint at some point. But yeah, I can see why that's followed closely there. And certainly through that same ad module as Facebook.
Facebook is 87. Instagram is 80%. But here's the interesting thing. 9% of people said it was their top performing platform, Instagram, that is.
Yeah, that's interesting to me. I'm curious what they mean by that, like top performing. Because what I have seen historically is from a brand awareness standpoint, yeah, it's great. But you can't get anybody to leave the platform in most cases, like you can Facebook, or at the rate that you can get them to convert from Facebook.
Maybe those were all influencers that were responding there. Who's to say? They also asked, when they were asked which digital advertising channels they plan to start using, one quarter said TikTok. So here comes, TikTok is coming.
Yeah, they don't know. They're just saying stuff.
They even had an open-ended question at the end of the survey where 116 marketers also identify TikTok as the, quote, next best thing in digital advertising.
Next big thing.
NBT.
Next big thing in digital advertising. I'd be curious how to cross-section that a little bit. What does that mean based for like consumer goods versus that B2B space, where we find ourselves a lot of times. But anyway, it's interesting. Again, it's got a little maturity to the platform now. It's not the newest thing in the world. The third finding is regarding the success of their digital advertising programs. Most marketers, they say, feel there is room for improvement. Well, that is encouraging. But no one's got it figured out is what we're saying.
They asked them, how do you rate the overall success of your digital advertising program? This is fascinating to me. 20% said they were very satisfied. 65% said they were somewhat satisfied. And then 11% they were neither satisfied nor dissatisfied. So they're on the fence. And then from there, 4% just went south, right? They were somewhat or greatly dissatisfied. One in five marketers say it's successful. It's very successful. That's crazy.
I'd like to talk to those 1 in 5 people. I'd be curious. And I'm sure there are some that I would go, whoa, that is impressive. Carry on. And I don't even know what you're doing here, you know, kind of a thing, right? I mean, there's going to be that cream of the crop, but 20%, like that is very successful. Anyway, it does say here, though, that the vast majority surveyed, like upwards of 95%, recognize there's a problem with their average conversion rates, as in they are not converting. They're low.
Well, from an advertising perspective, I still think we have a problem of going after the click. We still have problems connecting it in the post-click world of digital advertising. It's easier to follow in that route because, you know, the clicks are, that's the way we've traditionally been looking at the success. But now we got to get more sophisticated. You think when we start to talk more and more about how we have to target people and we have to become more effective with our digital advertising, it's to me, it's surprising that, you know, the majority of people are getting conversion rates that are still lower than 10%. And yet 45% of them say they're trying to optimize on those conversions. So we're spending a lot of time trying to run up a number that's less than 10% of our return. What is successful conversions for digital advertising? And I don't think we know.
Maybe we should all spin signs on the sidewalk next to one of those like inflatable things that fly in the air.
Finding four, both in-house teams and external partners are going to be vital, will be vital to the digital advertising success in 2021. They asked, who does the majority of the work? And interestingly enough, 57% of those that were surveyed, they say, have an in-house team. And 43% say, obviously, they rely heavily on agencies or tech-enabled service providers to accomplish their digital advertising goals.
I don't know that I've thought about that. Like, you know, how many in-house versus how many vendor-reliant. For example, at a hospital, it's like maybe you have a recruiting agency and they handle the recruitment marketing, which includes the media buying. But for marketing, it's all done in-house or something, you know?
Growth in agencies or tech-enabled services that was either a significant or a slight increase, so those are the growth, is around 55%. Whereas investing in your in-house team, the growth is around 54%. So I think we're just continually kind of navigating between going in-house and out-of-house and back to in-house and out-of-house as things go, right?
Yeah, and I've seen that pendulum swing through the years with different organizations. Let's hire a bunch of people to do it. And then it was, let's hire a bunch of people to do it.
Right? Yeah,
and it was exactly. Just, you know, on the inside or outside or what have you.
There's also this whole concept of a tech-enabled provider or tech-enabled services. And that's a big part of finding five, which we'll talk about after this break.
Coming soon from Greystone, Bowstring, and Touchpoint Media, live from HCIC, a new podcast that brings you front row access to the latest innovative strategies that are shaping tomorrow's healthcare industry. In this 12-part series, as recorded live at the Healthcare Internet Conference, we'll hear from industry experts such as Paul Madsen of the Cleveland Clinic, Kathy Smith of Roper St. Francis Healthcare, David Feinberg from Mount Sinai Health System, Rose Glenn from Michigan Medicine, and many others. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or your favorite podcasting platform. This podcast series is brought to you by Greystone.net, Bowstring, and Touchpoint Media.
All right, before the break, we covered findings 1 through 4. 1 through 4 of the 2021 Digital Advertising Trends Report by the folks over at PostClick. Survey done of about 1,500 or so, just shy of that, folks, back in October. Now we're kind of diving in on the last four findings. Finding numero 5, marketers who leverage tech-enabled services are more satisfied with their conversion rates than their in-house and agency counterparts.
The survey said that marketers who are using these tech-enabled services are achieving their digital advertising goals 4.4 times more likely than if they were doing it in-house or even with an agency. So what is that? What is a tech-enabled service company, Reed? I mean, we've been hearing about it. Clearly, a tech-enabled service company is one that very much specializes on not only advertising, but specializes on a variety of different capabilities, combining software with expertise around digital advertising to get great digital advertising results.
Sounds like an agency that does one thing. No, not really. And we have friends, obviously, in this space. I think that's why they've been successful, is because they have focused in. And to this point, they're experts in the technology. They've got some proprietary, like, algorithmic pieces to it or something like that that, you know, allow them to iterate quicker. Certainly, they do it continuously. So they've got, that level of expertise in benchmarking and knowledge.
They even outline in this article five, like, major appeals to companies as to why you want to leverage these tech-enabled services. And the first is they're more affordable than premium service providers because it's a part automation and human expertise. It uses machine learning, it uses technology, and it uses really smart people to get better results with a lower overhead cost.
Certainly, they're experts in the technology itself. That brings with it a lot of efficiencies, which actually is kind of the third point as well. You get faster results. So they're experts and you get faster results, a lot of which is because you're not having to hire and train folks and learn how to use the software, keep up with the advancements or the changes, et cetera.
And training is an important piece of another appeal of knowledge security, because really, if you're investing in one of these tech-enabled service providers, you're actually investing in their knowledge power as well. And moreover, a lot of this is hands-off for an organization, kind of a low touch for a brand or a company to work with these organizations. They say here, even 15 minutes a day can add up to 60 hours over the year, right? If you save that much time.
I wonder how much we'll see, I guess both sides, people moving away from agencies to the tech, you know, enable providers, or the agencies evolving to becoming that. Number six, marketers' top three digital advertising priorities are increasing their conversion rates, growing their return on ad spend, and enhancing their targeting and segmentation. And here in this report, they've got a whole laundry list of things, but 63% of the folks, and again, they got to pick three, right? So these obviously don't add up to 100, but 63% increase conversion rates, 58% at growing return on ad spend, 42% enhancing targeting and segmentation. Then you got a little bit of a drop off after that.
But that's interesting, right? Conversion rates, return on ad spend, and targeting and segmenting, that's really trying to appeal to that problem that we outlined earlier, that we're investing a lot of time focusing on conversions, but we're getting very low yield from our digital advertising spend. I think no wonder that's become their three top digital advertising priorities.
And I would say if you really focus in on that third one, the targeting and the segmentation piece, some of these other ones may solve themselves.
But they do call out here, though, there's this impending death of the third-party cookie and privacy. That's actually one of my favorite children's books, The Death of the Third-Party Cookie.
Yeah.
But anyway, so the point is here that they're trying to focus in on those things that actually matter. And I think that makes a lot of sense, which kind of leads to the seventh finding of the report. High-performing marketers leverage more platforms, optimize for conversions, and earn larger budget increases. And so they say here that instead of restricting themselves to the most popular platforms like Google and Facebook, high-performing marketers invest in a large number of advertising platforms, in effect, reducing their risk by limiting the impact of any one platform. So if suddenly there's an algorithmic change to Facebook advertising, your numbers just don't tank because you're all in on that platform.
You talk about people going like deeper and investing more in one space, right? Or trying to get more for their money. Or, I mean, this is talking about the fact that, you know, these marketers that are leading this space are kind of diversifying more, it sounds like.
I mean, they still look at Google really as the return on ad spend winner in all of this. I think Google kind of fits that pretty well, much higher than the other platforms. But they say here that unlike marketers with the get more clicks mentality, there's this kind of group of high performing marketers that are focused on post-click conversions. They're also focused less on vanity metrics and focus on those metrics that really contract to the bottom line. Here is the kicker, right? because these types of high-performing marketers are more successful, they're more likely to get rewarded with more budget. 39% of high performers expect a significant budget increase compared to just 20% of those average performers.
At some point, it's like if you're doing it well enough and you're able to really relay what that benefit is to the organization, then yeah, I mean, that makes sense.
All right. So let's go into the last finding, Reed.
Number 8, the Ocho. It's a dodgeball reference. Marketers think video personalization and artificial intelligence are the next big things in digital advertising. So let's break down each of those. So again, video, personalization, and AI.
When they asked them, what's the next big thing, right? This is where the TikTok thing came up before. Video came in first because it had 114 mentions in their open-ended comments. Consumers are not only preferring online video to television, but they're, according to Google and Comscore, they're also prefer YouTube to Facebook video.
I'd rather watch video online, specifically on YouTube.
And you're going to spend an average of 100 minutes per day or 12 hours a week watching those videos online is what Zenith, yeah, they're still around. They predict that in 2021, and that's up from 67 minutes a day in 2018. So now we're like spending an extra half hour with online video.
Boy, talk about pivoting. What is Zenith doing now? Anyway, I say 84% of consumers say watching a brand video has inspired them to make a purchase. 84%. Watching a brand video led to a purchase.
So let's get into the second one, personalization. We've talked about this a lot. What they're finding recently here is that Google found in 9 out of 10 cases, personalization yielded profits. Now that, you know, there are links in the show notes where you can actually find that out. And so they're saying here too that adopters, early adopters of personalization have seen a 15% lift of more revenue. And that's according to McKinsey.
Get there early.
But then what's the clincher here? 3 in 4 marketers are still struggling to scale their personalization efforts. And 65% of them said the whole personalization effort is completely overwhelming.
And they have left to go work for Zenith. No, it is. It is. It's really hard. I mean, it's like conceptually, it sounds like, yeah, we should be doing this. Right. And it's like, okay, let's get started. What's step one? Everybody goes, okay, I'm not sure, guys. I'm going to play some Google ads. It is hard and overwhelming. I mean, this is where a lot of technology comes into place. Certainly, it's really hard to do the personalization piece correctly if you don't have the building blocks, if you don't have the foundation there to do it. Now, you can do some personalization efforts around persona development and some of those types of things based on just how you're planning.
Then lastly is, of course, artificial intelligence. And again, if you're playing from home, bingo, that's your bingo card right there.
Mm-hmm. 8 in 10. Another high number, 80%, 8 in 10 early adopters reported a positive return on their AI investment. Now, this is based on a study from Deloitte, I believe.
Yeah, and we have to be careful here, right? This Deloitte study that we're referring to here, it is related to artificial intelligence, but it's more of an operational artificial intelligence investment, not necessarily artificial intelligence and advertising. AI and advertising is probably more synonymous with machine learning.
Yeah. I mean, certainly it's a way forward for a lot of folks. Advertising is a very interesting use case for AI and machine learning and those types of things. But yeah, 8 in 10, positive return.
This is a really interesting study. We really strongly encourage people that are listening in to go download it, particularly if you are in digital advertising. You know what is also interesting is I recently had a conversation with Anthony, who is actually the VP of compliance at the Network Advertising Initiative. Have you ever heard of the Network Advertising Initiative, Reed?
I have not.
They're actually a consortium that talks about setting advertising standards. And Anthony and I actually talked about how they actually have looked at healthcare and are providing guidance for not only these tech-enabled companies that we referred to earlier, but also for all marketers, digital marketers that are in the space, particularly in healthcare. It was a really interesting interview, and we'll listen to that after this break. All right, welcome back to the Ask the Experts segment of our podcast. And today I am delighted to be talking again with a gentleman that I've talked to before, but I don't think the listeners of our podcast have actually heard that previous conversation. And we'll get into that in just a second. But that is Anthony. And Anthony, you are with the Network Advertising Initiative.
That's right.
And Anthony, I was deliberately not pronouncing your last name because I want you to do so. It is certainly a very unique last name.
Thanks, Chris. And yeah, it's Anthony Matyshevsky. To I suppose make the most sense of it, it's sort of like Coach Mike Krzyzewski at Duke.
Ah,
same combination of S's and Z's and all that good stuff.
For people listening in, you and I had a conversation just prior to when COVID broke out. And in the mix of, moving to like actually start to talk about what's happening with COVID and the impact of hospitals, our interview just was kind of sitting out there. And we kind of circled back and said, it's time for us to re-record this now with the new eyes that we're in this now post-pandemic world.
That's right. Yeah, it was one of the last calls I had before lockdown. So,
well, I'm glad that we're back on the call again. And so for people listening in, they may not know about you and your background. Would you mind sharing a little bit about yourself and then also the Network Advertising Initiative?
Yeah, I'd be delighted to, Chris. So I'm Anthony Matyshevsky. I'm the Vice President for Compliance and Membership at the Network Advertising Initiative. I actually started working there as an intern in law school more than 10 years ago and have stuck around since then. So I definitely have accumulated some experience in the space. And through that time, I've been working with all kinds of ad tech companies and ad tech adjacent companies in trying to do the right thing from a consumer privacy perspective.
And that's what I loved about our previous conversation. We're going to get into it again with this one here too, is because really the focus of the Network Advertising Initiative is to kind of shift the way advertising is in terms of what's most relevant to consumers. Just share a little bit more about the organization.
The NAI came to be in the year 2000, and at the time, it was still kind of the wild west of the internet. I think those were the days of like spinning babies and pop-ups and all that fun internet advertising stuff from the early days. And at the time, DoubleClick, which was one of the biggest ad tech companies, later purchased by Google in a very big transaction. But at that time in 2000, DoubleClick was trying to merge with Abacus, which was an offline data broker. And all of a sudden, it made people realize that if you have an ad tech company that knows about people's, at the time, computers, and you have an offline data company, it wouldn't be a stretch of the imagination to consider that they may want to start linking the two together and associate people's browsing habits on the internet with their real life identities, or vice versa. And so the NAI was developed at this time. And this was, of course, back in the days when I think there was a Far Side cartoon that said, you know, on the internet, nobody knows that you're a dog. Meaning, of course, that you're anonymous when you're using your computer. And that probably wasn't exactly the case. I think people did know if you're a dog or not, and perhaps what kind of dog food you like if you are a dog, or what you're into if you're not a dog. And the NAI effectively set some base rules for what companies could do, what kind of data sets they could combine, could not combine, what kind of consent they needed from users, and also put some very baseline prohibitions altogether on kind of non-marketing uses of data, the concept of maybe using people's browsing habits or browsing information to establish their insurance rates or deny credit or healthcare or something like that. It prohibited all of that and set forth these ground rules that ad tech companies have used for the past 20 years to guide them and what are and are not responsible data collection and use practices online.
Some incredible foresight that your organization had. This was back in 2000, right? I mean, at the infancy of all of this. And here we are now sitting in 2021, kind of looking back. And, you know, for people thinking about how ad tech companies are now merging data and how that has become probably the hottest commodity, so to speak, of our internet world now, right? Of our digital world. The whole data brokering is such a thing. I imagine you saw a number of advancements over the last 20 years that has made this made your organization that much more important for organizations today. Is that true?
Yeah, so definitely the technology has developed very rapidly, not just in ad tech, but I think everywhere. So, you know, we went from pretty bulky devices on our desktops in 2000 to carrying around, you know, effectively supercomputers in our pockets and on our wrists today. You know, over the years, the technology in ad tech and for data collection use has kept up with that pace. So things have, you know, shifted to mobile. Now connected televisions are very big. As part of that process is also the concept of cross-device linking and trying to associate all the various TVs and phones and tablets and laptops and desktop computers out there, if they belong to the same user or something like that. There's also been a lot of advancements in what's called onboarding. So taking, you know, rather than what we just talked about previously with Abacus and DoubleClick, rather than taking people's browsing information and attaching that to their real world persona, onboarding is the opposite of that, is taking real world shopping or preference or interest information, usually stuff that sits in a company's CRM database, and activating that to target users online. Usually it strips out any kind of identifying information and just attaches sort of interest and in market info with a cookie ID or a mobile ad ID or something like that. And that really has changed the dynamic as well in terms of the merging of offline and online data. And it's allowed some other downstream products like, you know, much more accurate modeling, for example.
Back, you know, 20 years ago when you started ad tech companies, that was pretty much you could count them, right? It was a very finite set of groups. But now as a sophisticated of marketing technology, do you find that many businesses themselves have now developed their own data pools where the guidelines that you have outlined can maybe be applicable to them?
Yeah, I think so for sure. You know, over the years, I think there's also been a shift primarily from quote unquote ad networks, right, which were just groupings of websites that provided some insights into the users of those sites, to all kinds of platforms and service providers and, you know, self-serve technologies that advertisers or publishers can use to launch and guide and drive their campaigns without really any involvement from the ad tech company, aside from providing, you know, the pipes, so to speak, for that. And so advertisers and publishers are now much more in charge and oftentimes running their own campaigns and running their own digital advertising. So I think working with a reputable platform that's very clear about what is and is not permitted is important. But I think also it then starts falling to the advertisers and publishers as well to make sure that they're doing things right, because they may not have as much expertise in ad tech and the privacy norms as other companies.
One of the things that you focus on, Anthony, and how we got introduced is the fact that for our industry, for many of the listeners listening in, they not only, many of them are responsible for managing all of their advertising campaigns, but we're in the healthcare sector. And so there are specific guidelines that the NAI put together around healthcare. Is that right?
This is absolutely right. And, you know, initially, again, the concern was people's browsing information being associated with them. So our initial foray into sensitive data, try to focus on that. And we try to think of some health conditions or some health information that would likely be sensitive to most people. Obviously, using actual health and medical records and pharmaceutical records would fall under HIPAA, and that's something that no companies I'm aware of would use in actual advertising and marketing. But companies can make inferences, and we wanted to make sure that if a consumer browses a website to do research about a mental health condition or a sexually transmitted disease or perhaps a serious form of cancer or something like that, that they're not going to have to worry about being bombarded with ads following them around for treatment for an STD or mental health center or something like that, unless they've specifically consented to that ahead of time. And so we wanted to provide that bit of protection, that users can browse the web safely, they can go to WebMD, they can go to whatever websites, pharma sites and things like that, without needing about being sort of cast in an audience of, you know, STD sufferers or mental health problems or something like that. And so we've expanded on that. We acknowledge that there's also a lot of subjectivity there. You know, what about IBS or incontinence? You know, it's not cancer or an STD, but it's probably something you wouldn't want to get a targeted ad for or retargeted ad for, you know, in a common workspace when your colleagues are sitting around. So we added some additional requirements around transparency, having companies list all of the types of health-related targeting that they may engage in, so users can take a look and gauge on their own if any of these things are sensitive, and then make a choice whether to opt out or opt in to that kind of targeting.
You know, what's interesting as you describe this, Anthony, I know that as a digital marketer, we're, and particularly in healthcare, we're being really push to know our customers better, right? To analyze traffic on our websites and to be able to use that data to target more effectively. And I think that our intention as hospitals and health systems, that is, the intention is to really help ease the way people can access care. But it seems like these guidelines that you're describing actually give some good guidance around how far you can go in terms of personalizing those experiences.
I think there's always a tension between knowing your customers as well as you can and reaching them as effectively and efficiently as you can, and being mindful of their privacy. And so a lot of times I think, you know, it's about specificity, right? If it's knowing that someone might be interested in hospital services is different than knowing that, you know, they're a frequent visitor of the oncology department or what kind of cancer they may be suffering from. So there's a lot of guidelines there. Another thing that we've done is addressed modeling, because that really threw us for a loop, right? Because we've always thought about what are sensitive conditions and protecting consumers who are researching some of those sensitive conditions. But modeling works a little differently. That's more of a targeting tactic where you recognize that people who are in market for certain medicines or treatments tend to have certain demographic characteristics, maybe, you know, something as simple as gender and age, or maybe something more complex like gender plus age plus marital status plus education level or something like that. And then you target people based on that. So you're not targeting them because you think they have cancer or an STD. You're targeting them because they're male or female or over 30 or under 30. If you're doing, you know, an erectile dysfunction treatment, I think you can narrow your audience down pretty well just with age and gender, right? Or perhaps breast cancer treatment. And we didn't want to be in a position where we're not allowing that type of targeting, even though it might ultimately target people with a sensitive condition. So we put out a guidance document at the beginning of this year, which sets some ground rules and baselines as well for companies that want to engage in that kind of targeting in terms of, you know, what is a minimum audience size? What type of factors can go into that, that type of analysis and so on. And that's really been the latest bit that we've done in the health space that's gotten some positive attention and I think helped a lot, not just for our member companies, but also pharma companies and others who are looking to get into this space, looking to advertise to consumers, but don't want to infringe on consumer privacy at the same time.
Now, you put those guidelines out last year, right? At the beginning of last year or?
Yeah, it was. And I'm sorry if I misspoke. Yeah, it was January of 2020.
There's been a lot that has happened over the last year, right? I'm wondering if, you know, reflecting back on how one thing that we notice from a hospital and healthcare perspective is that our patients have become much more digitally natured, right? They're out there now searching very actively through digital channels for care solutions. And we've also introduced things like telehealth and other ways for them to connect with care. As you look at your guidelines, what you're describing around modeling, it seems to still apply, but have there been any changes that you've seen over the last year that may also influence these the way we're going to look at digital advertising in the future?
I think so. And you know, in the background with all of this, there's also been a tremendous shift in terms of just addressability. So, mobile ad IDs are becoming more difficult to access. Cookies are pretty much going away in web browsers. So companies are rethinking the way they engage with consumers more generally. It's a question of moving from these sort of random IDs that used to be assigned to devices and targeted pseudonymously to now more of a consent-based approach where if companies have to ask users for permission to, you know, track them effectively on their phones and on their websites, the companies are getting better at that, the messaging, the presentation of the consent screen. So I find that as more users engage digitally with their health providers and various health services, and companies are becoming more accustomed to a consent-based data collection and use process, there is more room, and I'm seeing more frequent attempts by companies to get consent from users. Tell them, you know, here, thank you for reading up on our newest treatment or on our newest medication that we're offering. You know, if you'd like to get more info or future info about this, you know, click here. That kind of consent-based approach seems to be working. And I think especially as users are engaging more directly on account of the recent health crisis and so on.
So this reminds me of GDPR and also in California, right, the CCPA. When you look at those new digital privacy laws that are in place now, and I think that other states are starting to address that, is that how you see this being maybe starting to manage more on a more formalized level?
I think so. So certainly GDPR brought a lot of attention to the privacy space, brought investment in resources and hiring and general expertise. CCPA did the same in California. I mean, I think they're different in many ways. One is an opt-in, while the other one is an opt-out regime. But nonetheless, they go into this and focus a lot of attention on privacy more generally. Now there's also CPRA, which just passed in November, maybe overshadowed a bit by some other November events, but CPRA passed in California, and that takes CCPA further, establishing such things as sensitive data that includes health conditions and things like that. And so companies are looking at those laws and at the same time, looking at the technology that's changing, making it more difficult for them to target users and collect data. And really, I think it's a confluence of those two things, the technical changes and the legislative changes that are pushing companies to basically a new model that's more based on consent and more based on first parties, whether it's publishers or advertisers that know their consumers, they know their audiences, and they want to reach them. And so they're taking more on in terms of getting consent finding users, making users available for targeting. And the ad tech companies are sort of shifting even more into a service provider role.
That's really an interesting divergence there, right? It's like this we're all in this together, right? And I know privacy is so paramount when we're talking about a healthcare specifically, right? Because there is a lot of sensitivity about that. Still to this day, we're hearing, you know, rumors of like a health system partnering with like a Google or what have you. And even on like AI initiatives or things that are not directly related to advertising, but the backlash towards privacy because of this known big tech model around, you know, data brokering, so to speak, it becomes of high importance in our space. Would you agree?
Oh, I think so. I think, as you said, it's really of paramount importance. I think without user, you know, without consumer trust, it's difficult for the entire ecosystem to be sustainable. So first, people have to trust that their data is not going to be misused or abused. They have to understand what's going on, at least in simple terms, because the technology and the data flows can be very complex and very complicated. So trying to explain to users and make them feel comfortable with what's going on, I think becomes even that much more important. The technical changes, the dynamics that are shifting really are putting more power in the hands of the advertisers and publishers, but it also more responsibility because now they need to convey messaging to users. They can't just say, oh, it's, you know, our website. I don't know what these other companies are doing here to help us target. So it's more power and more responsibility.
With great power comes great responsibility, I think someone once said, right?
I may have heard that at some point.
Exactly. So I'm also curious, you know, this sounds really like NAI is like right in the middle of all of this. How do you and your organization stay on top of ongoing trends? Because, you know, we look back at the last 20 years, right? Things move so rapidly. Things are going to be moving at a much faster pace even now. So what are ways that you kind of stay abreast of ongoing advancements in technology and keeping your guidelines up to date with that?
Maybe one of my favorite things about working at the NAI is the constant feedback loop that we receive from our members. So we're a self-regulatory body. We have about 100 ad tech companies that participate in our program, and we speak with all of them on a regular basis. At least once a year, they go through a thorough review where we look at their contracts and privacy policies and, you know, data flows and all of that. And then very often they'll reach out to us throughout the year, especially in the health space, with help around what is sensitive, what isn't, and feedback and guidance for that. But by speaking with our members every year, you know, we have a very good sense of what the ad tech industry is facing, what they're working on, what technologies are being sunset, what technologies are being developed, and we can adjust our requirements and our guidance based on that. And then the following year, we see how that worked. Did we open any loopholes inadvertently? Did we close the loopholes that we wanted to? And that process really helps us stay, you know, I want to say at least on pace with the developments and sometimes even a little ahead of them.
When we spoke last year, and now we're speaking again, a lot of what you're talking about is somewhat new to me, and I've been in this space for a very long time. And I think there are a lot of people listening in that this may be the first time they heard of NAI, and I think they want to learn a little bit more. So as we kind of close out this conversation today, what are some resources and ways that they could connect with both the NAI and you online?
Yeah, so I definitely recommend visiting our website, networkadvertising.org. And there you can find our code of conduct, our health guidance, various other health guidance documents, a list of all of our member companies, our board of directors, and contact info. I can personally be reached. It's just anthony@networkadvertising.org. Always happy to answer questions, even if a company's not a member. Happy to chat, talk through the requirements. We host an annual in-person summit that's open often to non-member companies. So we get out there and we're often at various events as well, including IAPP. Always happy to chat, but the best place to start is definitely the networkadvertising.org site. And I have quite a few blog posts on that site as well, specifically about health privacy challenges.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're going to link to all of that in the show notes. We'll probably also put a link out to you on LinkedIn, because people may want to have a conversation with you that way as well. But Anthony, this has been an incredibly interesting conversation, albeit it's our second time at having this conversation. I definitely will say this, you know, we won't let another year lapse before we have you back on, because the advancements of data privacy and how NAI is staying abreast of all of these situations is of really importance to the people listening in. So I really appreciate your time today.
Hey, Chris, thank you for having me on, and happy to be a resource.
All right. Special thanks to Anthony for coming on the show. I think advertising certainly is a big component of what it is that we do on a daily basis. And so it's a topic that we haven't talked about like on the nose like this in probably quite some time. And so it's great certainly to have somebody with that expertise to talk through it with us. That was a good episode. Obviously, a lot of the reason we got into this work or got into it doing this type of work. And so, yeah, I think this will be something certainly that will continue to evolve in 2021. I'm just really fascinated and curious on how personalization, the AI piece specifically, kind of play out based on what we're seeing from consumers right now.
Yeah, and I think that this is something that we definitely are going to look at with a closer eye as we move forward, particularly as we try to up those conversion rates.
Okay, so a couple of things. If you have not, go sign up for the TPS report. It's over at the website, touchpoint.health. Quick 5 articles each and every week. Also, scroll down to the bottom on that same email, links to all the upcoming conferences. So again, quick hit for you. You can check out stuff like the Mayo Clinic and ShishMed social media conference that's coming up. On over into the fall, you have the ShishMed in person, HCIC, HMPS, all that kind of fun stuff. So go check that out. If you haven't signed up for the email, do so. What do you have for a recommendation today?
Reid, I'm going to recommend a game that my wife and I are playing at home. I told you that, yeah, we play video games. We recently got turned on to a video game called Overcooked 2.
Overcooked 2. Okay.
Have you ever heard of this game?
No. Nope.
We like to just, you know, have games that we can kind of have fun, social. We don't have to spend a lot of thought and time in it. Overcooked 2 is a game that's called a cooperative cooking simulation video game. And basically what it is, you control independently 2 little cooks, and they're in a kitchen and they're getting orders, and they have to pull together the orders and cook the meat, chop up the vegetables, put the spaghetti on the plate, boil some rice, and get everything out in time. And you're kind of racing against the clock. It's a really fun kind of co-op game. Various different challenges. Like sometimes you have to throw things over a body of water to the other person because you're on 2 separate parts of a raft, you know, that sort of thing.
Nice.
And the whole point is it's so fast paced and you're going towards the clock that it's a great way to kind of devolve into, you know, games where you're kind of screaming at each other, I need more rice, I need more this or whatever, right? But in a very fun way. It's a very, very much a fun game. It's great for kids if you have kids at home. And it's available on a variety of different platforms, including you can get it on Windows, Nintendo Switch, PlayStation 4, Xbox One. You can even get on Steam if you're on Steam.
Oh, wow.
I highly recommend for anyone that's looking for a nice co-op game, just ultimately very pure fun playing, Overcooked 2. That's my recommendation this week.
Very, very nice. I'm also going to recommend a game. I assume it's available in a number of places, but it's chess, and specifically chess.com. And so you can get the app, which I typically play on an iPad or on my phone or something like that. But certainly I would assume you can play at their website, considering the app is called chess.com. I don't know. My granddad taught me to play chess when I was a kid, and it's fun. So you can play certainly a timed game, you know, like you would, where the time runs during your turn, you know, and that kind of thing. Or you can set up games with people, and you can set it where they have 1 day or 5 days or 2 days or 7 days or whatever to make their next move, right? So you make a move and you just kind of go away, and then you get notified eventually when they've made their next move. And so that's kind of fun too. You know, if you've got a bunch of friends on the app, you don't have to sit there and sit down and play a game. You can just do it one move at a time. So it's good. You know, I enjoy it. It's kind of fun. And it's a real basic looking chessboard, and but I like the app. It's got a good UI and works pretty well. Also has like videos and tutorials and training and stuff like that. If you want to, you know, understand chess, if you really want to study up on the Ruy Lopez opening moves or Queen's Gambit, you know, stuff like that, you can.
Nice.
The Sicilian defense, you know, things like that. So
nice.
Yeah. No, it's good. So anyway, it's chess.com. I'm sure there are a bunch of chess apps.
Or you could just get a board game of chess, right? And play it with someone. I mean, you don't have to go online, right?
Not really. That's not really. It's hard to social distance playing in person. So this is a COVID compliant way to play chess. So, all right, another good episode, great topic, and a fun one to do. Certainly, we like to talk through studies and kind of pontificate and, you know, chat and all that kind of stuff. And so that's been a lot of fun. Appreciate you guys hanging in there, listening to another episode. Would certainly love to hear from you. If there's topics we haven't covered, people we have not interviewed, reach out and let us know. Touchpoint.health is the website. For Chris Boyer, I'm Reed Smith, and we'll see you next week. This has been a Touchpoint Media production. To learn more about this show and others like it, please visit us online at touchpoint.health.